Legislative sessions in our neighboring states have finished or are counting down their final days. This hour, we check in with Missouri, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Nebraska. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. After a quick update with our own Joyce Russell about the Iowa legislature, we'll go to Brian Ellison of KCUR in Missouri. Of course, that huge scandal with the governor there. Then Brian Bax of Minnesota Public Radio, Sean Johnson of Wisconsin Public Radio, and Brent Martin, the news director at Nebraska Radio Network. A look across our borders, find out what's been happening on our neighbors' political landscapes. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this hour, without Joyce Russell, so to speak, as a co-host, but she'll be on in just a moment. We're checking in with legislative sessions in our neighboring states, checking the political landscape of Missouri, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Nebraska during the hour. It's interesting because on Mondays, of course, we focus on Iowa politics. It's now interesting to, after we've soaked up most of this session, to look across our borders and to see some of the same issues being dealt with and some completely different issues during this hour in Missouri, Minnesota, Nebraska, and Wisconsin. But of course, let's start off with Joyce Russell at the Iowa State House. Joyce, finishing up an overtime session at the Iowa legislature. Just want to have a quick conversation about how it's looking at this point.
Okay. Well, hello, Ben. We're back at the Capitol this week. At the end, the session was supposed to end last week. Went 100th day of the session was Tuesday, and there was a lot of optimism expressed that by the end of the week they would have an agreement on tax cuts. This is a high priority for Republicans in the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. But even though the same party has the majority all across the board, the Republicans have not been able to agree. This is Democrats are not at the table on this one. Republicans have not been able to agree on this tax cut package. The governor at her news conference today said they're back at the table today. They're still working. She said something like, well, we're still talking. Nobody took their ball and went home. Well, but there was tremendous optimism that this was going to get resolved last week so they could start this week and get going on the budget, get going on passing this tax bill. So kind of hard to predict just when there's going to be a breakthrough and how much longer the session's going
to
last.
Right, and it's hard to know what is exactly in this bill, right? We are, as are the Democrats, pretty much in the dark about the details on this bill.
Well, we're in the dark on what they're coming up with for a compromise. I mean, the Republicans in the House and the Republican Senate in the Senate have laid out their bills, but there are significant differences. But there are significant similarities. I mean, it's pretty clear they're going to cut income taxes. It's pretty clear they're going to raise some sales taxes. But beyond that, the size of this is a big issue. In general, the Senate plan is way more aggressive, cuts taxes quite a bit more, and from a Democrat's point of view, takes quite a bit more resources off the table as far as being available to pay for education and human services and all those other things.
Okay, Joyce, we'll look forward to your further reporting as this session winds up. Who knows when? We don't know if it's going to be this week, do we?
Oh, almost certainly will not be this week.
Oh, okay. There's a prediction. Joyce Russell, IPR State House correspondent. Looking forward to your further reporting there.
Okay. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Let's do a round robin of sorts to our neighbors. Let's go to the south with Brian Ellison. He's host of State House Blend Missouri for KCUR. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be with you.
Great to be with you. We're going to you, of course, first. Missouri has garnered a lot of national news, not in the way that Missourians would like, I'm sure. From the very start of the session, this scandal involving your Republican governor, Eric Greitens. Remind us, what is that about? It went way back to January, right?
That's right. We were all in Jefferson City for the State of the State address, the second Wednesday of the session, January 11th, and that's the night that about an hour after the address was delivered, a St. Louis television station broke the story that in 2015, before he was governor, Eric Greitens had had an extramarital affair. But as more and more information came out about that affair, that became a bigger story, including the allegation that at one point he took a picture of the woman involved and threatened to reveal it and talk about her and share this picture if she talked about their affair. And that has led to an ever-deepening crisis for the governor, including an indictment related to the taking of that photo. That happened in February. And the general consumption of the bandwidth of right. of all other possible discussions about Missouri government for the past few months.
Right. You said took a picture without getting an unnecessarily going a place that we don't need to go. But the picture was taken. It's a compromising picture.
Well, that's the allegation. Now, of course, the picture has not been it is not clear that the prosecutors have the picture, and the governor, at least his attorneys, have suggested that there was not any blackmail and that they're not even confirming that the picture was taken. More evidence has come into play with the release a couple of weeks ago of a report from Missouri House Committee that is investigating the governor. That's a process that could eventually lead to impeachment charges. They published 400 pages of a report that went into much more detail about what happened in this affair. According to the woman, they found her to be a credible witness. And those allegations included not only the taking of the photo without her consent, but a number of other sexual activities, some of which were non-consensual, according to her, that have led many lawmakers, both Democrats and Republicans, to call for the governor to resign immediately, and a good many of them to call for his impeachment. And that's before last week's felony indictment.
Right. Let's get to that in a moment. But first, I want to go back to some audio from your program, Brian Ellison. You spoke, this is from February. This is before the new charges, and we'll talk about those in a minute. You spoke with one of the first Missouri Republicans to call for the governor's resignation, Representative Kevin Corlew, Judiciary Committee Chair. Here's Representative Corlew speaking on your show, State House Blend Missouri, explaining why he doesn't feel it's appropriate for Governor Greitens to stay in office.
Well, one thing will be with the legal proceedings that go on, there'll be tremendous distractions, and the governor will be called from his duties that he won't be able to do day to day, in my opinion. But more so than that, when you talk about public officials and the direction that you're leading the state, there also has to be a sense of moral authority and belief from the people that your leader has the integrity and is able to lead forward. And it's hard to do so when that confidence has been shaken.
And you say that even before he's been convicted of these crimes, just with the indictment.
Right. And I am not suggesting in any means that Governor Greitens should be convicted at this point. I think the process should be work out in the criminal aspect. And of course, those proceedings need to be fair and make sure they follow all the procedures there. But from a leadership standpoint in the governor, that's another issue. And I think that we need to hold representatives and officials accountable just like anybody else. And we need to make sure that we have leaders that can really effectively govern at this time.
Brian, that was you speaking with Representative Corlew, Republican representative there in Missouri, way back in February. So much water under the bridge since then. Just last week, talk about the new charges against the governor.
Well, right, and as it turns out, he was prophetic in predicting that this would cause a lot of distraction for the rest of the session. The new charge last week stems from an investigation that has been ongoing from the Attorney General, Josh Hawley, who is also a Republican and who is also running for the United States Senate, seeking to unseat the incumbent Democratic Senator, Claire McCaskill. Josh Hawley's investigation has ranged over a few different issues in the governor's office. One was the use of a text messaging app that destroyed messages after they were read. The governor and some of his staff were using this, possibly in violation of Missouri Sunshine Palestine laws. No criminal wrongdoing was found in that investigation, but there was another investigation. The AG oversees the work, the nonprofit organizations in the state, and the use of a donor list by the governor's gubernatorial campaign. That's a list from the charity that the governor founded back in 2007 called The Mission Continues. It's a veterans charity. That charity got a hold of a donor list, and we knew that already. In fact, they'd already paid a fine for a campaign violation in not reporting that as an in-kind charitable gift. But last week, the Attorney General said there's evidence of criminal misconduct. Apparently, the governor personally implicated in obtaining and using that list. He referred that evidence to the St. Louis City Circuit Attorney. That's the same prosecutor who is prosecuting him on the invasion of privacy charge related to the affair. And she, on Friday afternoon, filed a second felony charge against the governor, which many legislators are saying, you know, especially some Republicans said, it might have been difficult for us to cast that vote for impeachment based on personal conduct that happened prior to the campaign for governor. Mm-hmm. But in this case, this might be the final straw for many of those, even those Republican legislators. Of course, Democrats are fairly united at this point in calling for impeachment as soon as possible.
Right. So how does the governor defend himself in the face of the slew of allegations and the trial to start, I guess, next month, huh?
Yeah, that's right. It's scheduled for May 14th. The governor has been defiant in his response in a series of press conferences. He's called this a, quote, political witch hunt, even though the calls for his resignation have come now from both Democrats and Republicans. He's connected the Democratic prosecutor in St. Louis with liberal billionaire George Soros. And, of course, he's also denied any suggestion that there was blackmail involved in the affair. He has filed his attorneys have filed three different motions to dismiss the case based on various aspects of the prosecutor's conduct. The judge has rejected all three of those motions. Even this afternoon in a St. Louis courtroom with that same judge, Ben, there's going to be another discussion over whether an investigator that the prosecutor used committed perjury in how he testified in one of those previous proceedings. So there's a lot of ongoing legal effort to try to undermine the prosecutor's case. The governor is definitely not conceding anything or giving up, and he has said he will not resign.
Yeah, so it's not as if you're waiting any day, any hour to get the notice he's resigned. You're not expecting that.
No, I think that's an interesting question for newsrooms. I think any newsroom would want to be prepared for such an outcome. But I have to tell you, this governor, as you probably know, he campaigned on the idea that he was an outsider. He's a former Navy SEAL. He's a fighter. He talks about his boxing coach that he grew up learning lessons from. There is absolutely no indication that Eric Greitens intends to leave office without a fight.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brian, there in Missouri, I don't know, State House Blend, if you ever have callers or you get out to talk with Missourians, what's his support, the support for the governor, been like over these last few months? It has to be waning, I'm guessing.
It certainly is waning in terms of the other Republican elected officials. Obviously, Josh Hawley, who came into office at the same time as he did, and they often were seen together and were seen as allies to each other. They have completely separated at this point. Most Republican office holders, certainly in the legislature, have called on the governor to resign. As far as voters, though, go, I think that's a more difficult question. There was a poll out last week that showed the governor's approval rating at something like 38% in the state, so not so different than the president's approval rating. Governor Greitens has been making appearances at various county Republican gatherings. There were two different ones here in the Kansas City area last weekend where he got a standing ovation. So there at least is some element of the party faithful that is still standing with the governor. Having said that, there's the loudest voices in the party are calling on him to resign, as are most of the Democrats. We should remember that Republicans control the House and the Senate. They have more than two-thirds of each of those chambers and all of the statewide elected offices but one in Missouri. So the party really will be determinative about his future in all likelihood.
Mm-hmm. What about the legislative session? With this having, I imagine, sucked most of the oxygen out of the room for other issues, are things getting done? Are new laws being crafted there in Missouri?
Yeah, there are a lot of laws being debated. I think it is fair to say this has been a huge distraction, and much of that conversation about legislation has been out of the limelight compared to what it would have been otherwise. One thing that is very different is that the governor does not seem to be the primary mover in terms of what legislation gets passed or discussed. So here in Missouri, as in many states, ordinarily the budgeting process begins with the governor's proposal and everyone works from there. This year in the State of the State address, the governor also said he would propose the, quote, boldest tax reform plan in the nation. That tax plan has been largely ignored. His budget has been several aspects of it, including a major cut to higher education and a reduction in funding for K-12 education. That's been largely ignored by legislators. They've gone about their business, though. There's important legislation coming through relating to that budget, relating to tax cut plans by various Republican legislators. There's discussion about funding transportation, and there's even conversation about gun laws in Missouri, including advancing some bills that would actually loosen Missouri's gun laws, even after a considerable national conversation about more gun control.
Mm-hmm. Brian, we have just a minute left, but I wanted to go back to your mention of your Democratic U.S. Senator, Claire McCaskill, up for re-election. Here's what Politico had to say in an article. Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill is up for re-election, and like clockwork, the Republican Party of Missouri is in complete turmoil again. So take us back 6 years. It was the GOP Representative Todd Akin with a comment about legitimate rape, right? That did help this Democratic senator gain her election then.
Yes, Senator Claire McCaskill, known as a very savvy campaigner, she actually supported Todd Akin's nomination 6 years ago, knowing that he was the opponent she wanted to have. He did make that comment where he said that in cases of, quote, legitimate rape, a woman's body can shut down a pregnancy. He was obviously ridiculed. His own party called on him to step out of the race. He refused to do so, and she was elected. There was a lot of concern. In fact, still, most onlookers would say that her seat is among the most vulnerable Democratic seats in the U.S. Senate. But as you say, already there's been suggestions that Josh Hawley, her now likely Republican opponent, has had to take extraordinary steps to distance himself from his party's chief flag bearer in the governor. It's going to be a very interesting race. Hawley is himself, so far, relatively untainted by any sort of scandal, but there are Democrats who are raising the point that this investigation into the governor's charity has been going on for a long time now. Why is this evidence only being turned over to prosecutors now? Some see political opportunism in that. I guess we'll have to wait and see what the voters say.
Fascinating. Brian Ellison, thank you for giving us a view across the border into Missouri from here in Iowa. Brian Ellison, host of State House Blend Missouri for KCUR. We appreciate it, Brian. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're looking at sort of a regional roundtable of legislatures surrounding Iowa. Let's go north to Minnesota. Brian Bax is with us, Capitol correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Ben.
So just to set the scene, Republican majority legislature there in Minnesota, Democratic governor Tim Pawlenty, who's been there forever, right?
Democratic Governor Mark Dayton.
Mark
Tim
Dayton
is trying to make a comeback, so we'll get probably to him later.
Yep. So tell us, what's been going on at the legislature?
There's a month left to go, and they're debating a whole range of issues from guns to taxes. Of course, this federal tax overhaul passed in December. Hello?
Okay, we're okay, Brian. Go ahead. We're still hearing you.
Yeah, sure. This federal tax overhaul that passed in December was a big deal for Minnesota because it's one of those high-tax states where if they do nothing, taxes are going to go up on a whole lot of people. So that's going to dominate the last 4 weeks of the session. Republicans are out this week with a proposal to cut some income tax rates, and the governor has previously put out his plan to offer some more tax credits. So that's going to be the nub of the discussion for the week, the last month of the session.
Mm-hmm. Some other issues there. I understand school security with the school shootings nationwide has been an issue. Legislation coming of that?
That's right. This is one of the consensus areas we've seen this session where from the governor to the lawmakers, they're going to do something, give schools more money to either hire more security officers, put up bulletproof glass if they'd like, or hire intervention counselors to help with troubled students. That's one of the areas that they are going to overlap. But some people want them to also tackle some gun legislation. But the Republicans who control both chambers of the legislature aren't going to take those up. Or they haven't yet, and said that it's unlikely that they can get anything passed. There's a very rural bent to the Republican majorities. So gun legislation isn't very popular in their ranks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and some here may have the impression, you allude to the Republican majority in the legislature, but you know, nationwide, you look at Minnesota on a map, it's always blue. So how is Minnesota a blue state with a Republican majority?
Minnesota's blue status is a little bit more complicated than people think. The urban centers and the suburbs have trended more in the Democrats' direction, but there's a whole swath of Minnesota that's very Republican. So Republicans have done well in the legislative elections. They haven't won a statewide race since 2006, and they haven't won it from the presidential contest since 1972, and that's the longest anywhere in the country.
Okay. Another issue here. We're coming up on a break. We've got a couple minutes here, and then hopefully you'll be able to stay with us and join us for a few minutes after the break, Brian. But talk about the other national issue that your state legislature is dealing with. I understand opioid abuse has been something that's been debated there.
That's right, and there's our various proposals to build awareness and to help with prevention. But the one issue where they're divided is how to pay for all of it. The governor wants to impose a penny a pill tax on opioid, and so basically get the drug manufacturers to have some skin in the game in dealing with this crisis. The Republicans in the legislature aren't interested in that. They say that there are other pots of money that they can draw from. So they see eye to eye on a need to do something. They just don't see eye to eye on where to get the money to do that something.
Mm-hmm. And the opioid epidemic is as present in Minnesota as it is in states to varying degrees, right?
That's right. There's a growing number of people who are addicted to it, and a lot of deaths attributed to it. Of course, we just passed the second anniversary of Prince's death, and he was overcome by an opioid problem, and so it's been front and center in Minnesota for a few years.
Mm-hmm. Prince, a native of the Twin Cities, right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. State has had some problems getting some new technology. What's that about?
Yeah, a lot of these legacy computer systems that states like Minnesota have had for issuing driver's licenses or vehicle license plates have been going through these upgrades, and Minnesota just brought one online last year, and it has been nothing but problems. People have been getting delayed plates. They sometimes can't even get a plate for their car. So lawmakers have been trying to figure out who's to blame, who to hold accountable, and what to do about it. So they've been pushing some more money toward getting these emergency fixes. And it's just endemic of a lot of these issues of technology that states are facing, whether it be replacing these systems or upgrading their cybersecurity defenses, because a lot of states are being hit by possible intrusion and attempts to hack into the system, because there's a bunch of information that's valuable that states collect and maintain through transactions with their citizens. So Minnesota is having this debate. It's not clear as to whether they're going to put a lot of money towards cybersecurity, but it's on their radar.
Mm-hmm. Brian Bax, please hang on. We're going to go to a break and be back with Brian, Capitol correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio, as we look across the border north in this case. I want to talk with Brian, get his view on, I misspoke earlier, the former Minnesota governor, perhaps a comeback. We'll talk with Brian about that. Also, repercussions from that resignation of Minnesota U.S. Senator Al Franken. We'll talk with Brian about that when we come back. Following that, we'll jump over to Wisconsin. What an interesting case there. We'll talk with Sean Johnson of Wisconsin Public Radio. Of course, we have Paul Ryan saying he's not going to run for re-election. All kinds of things happening in Wisconsin to explore in our next half hour. Brent Martin will join us, news director at Nebraska Radio Network. It's a regional roundup of legislatures, our neighbors, their politics. Stay tuned. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, checking in with our neighbors around Iowa to see how their legislatures, their politics have been doing as we wrap up Iowa's legislative session sometime in the next couple weeks. It is thought, we're talking at the moment with Brian Baxt, a Capitol correspondent for Minnesota Public Radio. Brian, let's finish up a couple things in a few remaining moments that we have. Now, of course, Al Franken's resignation happened way, well, that was right at the start of the year, wasn't it, resigning. And so it's interesting, this gives Minnesota two U.S. Senate races this year on the ballot, right?
1978 that's happened, and it just adds to an already overloaded election calendar for Minnesota. I'm exhausted just thinking about it. We have an open governor's race. We have, of course, races for attorney general, secretary of state, and auditor. And there's at least four nationally competitive congressional races in Minnesota. So there's going to be a lot of time, money, and attention put on Minnesota this year.
Mm-hmm. And because of the appointment, someone had to fill Al Franken's seat after he resigned. That kind of put a little bit of a domino effect that resulted in some sort of a strange dynamic or strange setup, huh?
Absolutely. Governor Mark Dayton, who's a Democrat, appointed the successor to Al Franken, who is his Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith. Well, that person, she had to resign her post of Lieutenant Governor, so the next person in line for that was the Senate President. Well, the Senate is split 34-33 in favor of Republicans, and that Senate President happens to be a Republican, but she decided she's not going to leave her Senate's post. She's going to try to do both jobs. It's touched off litigation, because if she had to depart or was removed, it would create a tie and a special election for control of the state Senate. So it's been this back and forth. A lot of people are watching her votes to see if she's decisive on any matters and see if that will result in any legislation that gets overturned, because she was voting on it at the time she was lieutenant governor.
Mm-hmm. Okay, last comment. Back to Tim Pawlenty, the former governor, Republican governor of Minnesota, 2003 to 2011. He's planning a comeback.
He announced his campaign for governor this month, and of course, he's been gone for 8 years. He was the last Republican to win a statewide race in Minnesota. He served two terms and then tried to run for president, left and went to Washington to be a lobbyist for a financial services group. And so he's back. He's facing a lot of questions about the record he had as governor and the things he's done since he was governor.
Mm-hmm. How are his chances looking at this point against Mark Dayton, who's running for re-election, I assume?
No, Mark Dayton is not running for re-election, so it's an open seat. He's likely to face either Congressman Tim Walz or the former State House Majority Leader Aaron Murphy or State Auditor Rebecca Otto. Either way, it's going to be a competitive race. Governor Pawlenty never won a head-to-head race. He always had the benefit of having a third-party candidate in the race to kind of split up the votes on the Democratic side. So he could be in for a tough go this time.
Wow. Brian, you do indeed have a busy political landscape up there in Minnesota. Good luck covering it. We'll, at some point in the future, hopefully check back with you. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's move to Wisconsin. Sean Johnson is there for us, Wisconsin Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Ben.
So give us the lay of the land in the Wisconsin. We've been rotating around Iowa's neighbors here over to Wisconsin. Huge Republican majority there in the legislature. You have Scott Walker as governor.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, as far as what our legislature is doing, they've been done for a while now. I mean, they're in full campaign mode at this point. In Wisconsin, we do have, as you mentioned, Governor Walker has been elected in two regular elections. He also won a recall election, and he's up trying to seek a third term this November. In the Senate, you have an 18-14 Republican majority. The Assembly has a 63-35 seat Republican majority. So that is where things start headed into the November election.
Mm-hmm. With that kind of unified Republican government, have there been any, within Republican ranks, any conflicts, contentious issues?
Yeah, a lot. I think this year, or I guess this legislative session, more than in the past. They've been very willing to fight openly, Republicans have, over, you know, for example, the state budget. There was a lot of angst among Republicans over the transportation budget, for example. There was a pretty sizable contingent of Republicans who wanted to come up with some kind of new revenue, a tax or fee increase to pay for roads. And that's partly because a lot of the Republicans in southeast Wisconsin and the Milwaukee suburbs had big projects that stood to see delays or, you know, cancellations without some kind of new revenue. And then you had a lot of lawmakers, GOP lawmakers from rural Wisconsin where roads are deteriorating. So you had that contingent of Republicans who are willing to kind of stick their neck out for a tax increase. And then you had another contingent of Republicans who said, no way, that's not what we stand for. Scott Walker, the governor, sided with them. And so our budget dragged on quite a long time. And, you know, I think you could argue there's still bad blood over that.
Mm-hmm. A few years ago, Sean, here in Iowa, of course, infrastructure, funding of road maintenance and so forth was a big deal. And our governor then, Branstad, sided with the, unlike Scott Walker, there was a rise in the gas tax to pay for funding. But Scott Walker there in Wisconsin says no way.
Yeah, he's been pretty, I guess you could say that his tone has kind of evolved on this issue, where he's signaled at times an openness to look at different types of funding for roads. But headed into, you know, his election for a third term as governor, he was pretty clear that he did not want to sign a gas tax increase, and that position became more and more firm as the budget debate dragged on.
Mm-hmm. Sean, as you heard before we spoke with you, we were getting a read on Minnesota politics, and school safety has been an issue in their legislature. In Wisconsin as well?
Yeah, before they wrapped up for the year this year, the legislature passed a $100 million school safety plan that was an initiative of Governor Walker, got broad bipartisan support in the legislature, and it will be a grant program for schools to make physical safety improvements to their buildings, for example. They're rolling it out right now. There's been a lot of interest from school districts. That's where Republicans went in Wisconsin as part of a special session that the governor called. There was nothing in that special session that included any kind of restrictions on gun purchases, though. Republicans said that, you know, they just didn't want to go there, that they were never going to find consensus on that. And you had Democrats saying, well, you're only addressing part of the problem here.
Mm-hmm. Back to tax cuts, I understand controversy there over a big tax incentive for a big company in one part of Wisconsin.
Yeah, so last year, Wisconsin passed a massive tax incentive package for the Taiwanese electronics giant Foxconn. It was about $3 billion in state money. And when we talk about this in state money, this would be the state over time cutting checks that add up to $3 billion for Foxconn to build a massive TV screen manufacturing plant in southeast Wisconsin. If you include local incentives, the number gets to be more like $4.5 billion. So this is something that, you know, we've never seen a deal of this magnitude in Wisconsin. And there was some talk at the time that, you know, this could be kind of a slippery slope, that other businesses in Wisconsin might be wondering, hey, why am I not getting similar money from the state when I've been doing business here for years? You actually saw that argument kind of play out this year when Kimberly-Clark, which manufactures consumer products up in the northeast Wisconsin, announced it was going to fire 600 people to close a couple plants there. The government stepped in under the direction of Governor Walker and said, don't leave. We'll offer you an incentive package that is on a percentage basis the same as what Foxconn got. In that situation, it didn't pass the full legislature. You had Republicans saying, we're not sure if this would even work. You know, there's no guarantee that if we pass this, that Kimberly-Clark would stay. But that is an example of kind of where, you know, state government here is headed now in terms of government intervening in, you know, the private sector.
Mm-hmm. Scott Walker running for re-election, how popular is he?
He is about, the last poll that we had from Marquette University showed that his approval rating was at about 47% approve and 47% disapprove.
Mm-hmm.
And if you dug down into the numbers for that poll and the actual number of people who responded to that question, it was dead even. So that is where Scott Walker is in terms of his approval. And that's about the sweet spot for him. He doesn't really get too far above that, or hasn't at any point in his governorship. And so it's a decent place to be. I guess the question is whether that's going to be enough for him, or how he will weather potential Democratic wave that he's been warning his base about, because he has stood for election previously in 2010, 2014, good Republican years. His recall election was kind of a special situation where a lot of people voted for him because they didn't like the idea of recalling a sitting governor. So this is going to be a different test for him, a more favorable climate for Democrats. And there are a lot of Democrats who are thinking that they want to be the candidate that takes Governor Walker on.
Are there any standouts, front runners among the Democrats, personalities that voters there think may be able to take on Walker?
I think the thing that stands out about our Democratic field is sort of the lack of standouts. There are, you could say, like 9 or 10 Democrats right now that have some kind of established support in Wisconsin who are running for governor right now. If you take all the candidates who are technically running, that is, they've filed with the state, you might not have heard of them, but they have filed the paperwork that says, I'm a candidate for governor. The number is 17. And nobody's quite sure how this is going to shake out. I mean, the most prominent candidate on that list is arguably our state superintendent of public instruction, which is officially a nonpartisan job. And so when you look at these polls on who you favor among Democratic voters, you know, which is your favorite candidate, the standout winner in those polls is undecided, don't know enough. You know, that's kind of the state of the Democratic field at this point, and they only have a few months before the August 14th primary.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Sean, a few words about Paul Ryan. We found out he will not seek reelection. A surprise, I think, to many. How much of a shock was that up there in Wisconsin?
I think ever since Politico and some others started reporting that he was pretty strongly weighing getting out of politics, I think that was back in December, that was quite a shock. And maybe that lessened the shock when he actually announced he wasn't going to run again. But he has been a big figure here for a long time. Obviously, he's a national figure, but in Wisconsin, Paul Ryan's been there for a long time. He is a big deal, especially in Republican politics.
Right. In soaking up the legacy of Paul Ryan nationally, was it, you saw all the coverage on it, was it different there in Wisconsin? I mean, he's had to deal with a unique president, partner with a unique president.
Yeah. I mean, if you talk to people in his district in terms of what they thought about Paul Ryan, this is the day that he announced that he wasn't going to run again, what they said was very similar to what you heard nationally. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot of people there who adore Paul Ryan and said he's had his hands full with President Trump. And, you know, I wouldn't blame him for getting out of there to spend more time with his family. But you had, even in, you know, the heart of his district, you had a lot of critics there who said what you hear critics say of Paul Ryan on the national stage, that he hasn't done what he said he was going to do with debt, for example, that, you know, that he's had too much, I guess, of a focus on cutting popular programs like Medicare, Social Security. I would say that the debate on Paul Ryan that you hear here is very similar to what you hear nationally. The difference would be maybe in Republican circles, where the Republican Party is now not going to have one of its premier leaders on the ballot in November, and so that's a little bit of an ideological blow, you know, for them.
Yeah, right. Sean, if I can ask you in 30 seconds to tell us what about Paul Ryan's seat? Is that district going to be up for grabs, possibly Democratic?
You know, it's a pretty strong Republican seat. So just for example, we had a state Supreme Court race recently, and if you the Liberal candidate won that race by 12 percentage points statewide. But if you break her vote down by congressional district, the conservative candidate won Paul Ryan's seat by about 5 percentage points. So even in a big Democratic win, that seat still went Republican. Okay. Paul Ryan never really had a close call there. So it would be an uphill battle for Democrats to take it.
Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief. Thanks for giving us the view of Wisconsin politics at this time. We appreciate it, Sean.
All right, thank you.
River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Finishing up with our neighbor to the west, Nebraska, Brent Martin is news director at Nebraska Radio Network. Hi, Brent.
Good morning. How are you?
Well,
this afternoon.
We're just into the afternoon. I think we're in the same time zone, aren't we?
Yeah.
We are.
Unless we get to Western Nebraska.
There you go. So we love to talk about Nebraska and your one chamber legislative body there. What's been going on?
Well, the biggest thing this year was trying to adjust the budget. Nebraska does a biennium two-year budget. It passed it last year, but revenue has not met projections. And so really, the legislature went right back into budget mode and had to spend the short 60-day session this year primarily working on the budget. There was also controversial language inserted by Governor Pete Ricketts restricting federal family planning funding, mainly, critics say, to keep it out of the hands of Planned Parenthood. But that got into the budget mix as well. Those were probably the big issues, and also there was an effort to try to bring back relief, but that didn't work.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of whine on the line, a technical problem. We're still hearing you, though, Brent, just to let you know. So that shortfall, that budget shortfall, the ag economy, you're in a lot of ways like Iowa there in Nebraska, right?
Yes. The state depends a lot on agriculture, just probably more so than Iowa. The Lincoln and the Omaha economies are very strong, robust, as they would say, but the agricultural economy really drives the state. It's at least a quarter, just directly a quarter of the state's economy, and then probably upwards around half if you take in the indirect effects. And so the commodity prices, when they dropped, it really hurt the incoming revenue to the state, and that caused a real budget pinch. Also, child welfare services have really increased in cost. So we had about $175 million less in revenue than projected, and an increase of $55 million plus in child welfare, and for an $8.8 billion two-year budget, that's a big chunk.
Mm-hmm. Also concerned there, I imagine, in your ag economy about the possible escalation of the trade war with China, right?
The trade is very Nebraska agriculture depends on trade, and the discussions, which first started when NAFTA started making people out in Nebraska agricultural sectors very nervous, and that those nerves have continued to build as more and more of the quote-unquote talks about trade war have surfaced. And so, yes, agricultural sectors here in Nebraska very much looking at Washington, looking at trade policy, and really lobbying for expanded free trade. Nebraska very much, at least the congressional delegation, very much in favor of free trade, and very nervous about the talk that's going on in Washington now about possible trade wars.
A couple other items of interest. I understand a bill passed that allows self-driving cars in Nebraska.
Yes, that was really probably one of the more interesting bills that passed this year, and interesting because the bill started out as a pilot project in Lincoln. They were going to try some kind of like Uber or Lyft type vehicles to see how they operated and just test them out in Lincoln. And there was an amendment placed on it that just basically took it statewide. Now, there are some regulations, some rules about it, but it will allow self-driving autonomous vehicles throughout Nebraska under certain rules and regulations.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it may come in handy on those long stretches of
I-80. Yeah, you go I-80 through there, yeah.
Oh, boy. You can think of some things you can do that now that you don't have to drive, perhaps in the near future.
Right.
Also, sexual harassment. What's going on there in Nebraska in terms of legislation there?
There was a bill passed that increased disciplinary oversight of the Nebraska State Patrol. Start out that way. It also does some other things to other police departments. But within that, there were some allegations of sexual harassment within the patrol. But what they did was they took it and they made it so there was, if state workers would raise allegations of sexual harassment, they would be shielded from retaliation, because that was one of the complaints, that we could bring these things up, but our jobs are at stake. We could either get fired or demoted or something like that. And so the bill is statewide, not just confined to the patrol, but for all state workers, that will shield any state worker who brings up allegations of sexual harassment, that they would be shielded from retaliation.
Mm-hmm. And that looks to be that passed, and that will become law?
That passed. The governor is deciding today whether to accept or veto it, but there's no indications that he would veto it.
Mm-hmm.
He could. It was passed on the last day of the session, and the governor said that he's going to decide on vetoes by today.
Okay.
End of the day.
Okay, and so the session is done there?
The session is done. It wrapped up. We have a 90-day session and then a 60-day session. It's the 60th day was last Wednesday. It's wrapped up. Governor has about five days to decide whether to sign or veto legislation, and then it's done. And in Nebraska, they consider vetoes within the legislative session, so there's nothing they can do. If the governor were to veto anything, they can't do anything about it because they've adjourned sine die.
Okay, Brent Martin reporting for us, giving us a view of what's been happening in Nebraska's unicameral legislature. News director at Nebraska Radio Network. Brent Martin, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Coming up tomorrow, I speak with Teresa Hafner. She would not be alive today with the heart that she was born with. She lives because of a motorcycle crash that killed another woman. Tomorrow, one of my guests, heart transplant recipient Teresa Hafner of Swisher, Iowa. Hope you'll tune in for that tomorrow. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Natalia Reyes. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. River to River@iowapublicradio.org. Our email, River to River@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.